Well, stay tuned. Coming up in the local news hour this morning, I'll be talking with State Representative Tim Quinn. We'll be talking about the outcome of last week's special session. Republican candidate for Utah House of Representatives 54th District looking to replace the retiring Tim Quinn is Randy Favero. And then Heber City Council member Rachel Kaler has a recap from last week's council meeting. First, the the Park City has canceled the traditional 4th of July parade on Main Street due to health restrictions related to the COVID-19 pandemic. KPCW's Sean Higgins has more.
Jenny Dearson is Park City's Economic Development Program Manager. She says the decision to cancel the parade came down to worries over people crowded on sidewalks.
You know, as we've continued to, adapt to the COVID, what I'll call the COVID lifestyle, I think really at this point in time, we do not feel it is responsible as a city to be hosting a parade where people would potentially gather for really any amount of time in a stationary form, if that makes sense. So generally people line up on the sidewalks and they might be there for an hour or two, very closely together. And so we're not comfortable at this point in time moving forward in that type of an activity.
The Historic Park City Alliance is surveying Main Street business owners to gauge their interest in making Main Street car-free on the 4th, much like the current car-free Sundays already happening this summer. Dearson says since businesses are already operating with health precautions in place in order to do business on the street during car-free Sundays, extending those to the 4th would be the safest way to hold an event for the holiday. If Main Street is to close to car traffic on the 4th, it would be from early in the morning until 10 p.m. as opposed to the 11 a.m. to 10 p.m. closure on Sundays. Dearson says the decision on whether or not Park City will host a fireworks display this year is still up in the air and will be dependent on monitoring the ongoing health situation and fire safety levels.
The goal for fireworks, too, will be that really they will be for our residents to watch from their neighborhoods and those that are patronizing the street and supporting local business. We are not encouraging people to come up and, you know, watch the fireworks from afar in this sense, but again, feel knowing our community that 4th of July is an important holiday for our community to celebrate.
The city is hoping to make a decision on fireworks by next week. Sean Higgins, KPCW News.
It's 8:12 now. Well, the Park City Council gave its staff the okay to move forward with designing a new permanent contaminated soils repository on the city's eastern border and to make room there for a new recycling center. Park City Council member Tim Henney says the city has been struggling with what to do with the contaminated soil left over from the city's mining days. For years, that toxic soil was dumped at Richardson Flat, but that has since been closed to all but the property owner's private use. While some of the soil can stay on a construction project, and others have paid big bucks to have it trucked to the Twilla repository more than 100 miles away. Henney says the city is following up on a recommendation made by the Soils Advisory Committee more than a dozen years ago.
We've already seen a lot of projects that have borne significant additional costs because of having to take soils down to Twilla. And this is trying to address that. So it's not only for our projects, but it would also be for some of the smaller scale residential projects. I think that's important, too.
The repository would be built on city-owned property near Quinn's Junction, known as the Gordo Parcel. Some 35,000 cubic yards of contaminated soil is already there, and it's estimated that the city will add another 50,000 cubic yards as it prepares the arts and culture property for development. Henney isn't sure how much soil could eventually be placed there, but it would be open to residents who are doing small construction or landscaping projects. Like a landfill, a big pit would be dug, then lined, and eventually capped once it's filled. Henney says eventually it could be used as field space or even housing built on top. The location is deemed as a good one for the future site of a new Recycle Utah because of the construction plan of the Arts and Culture District. Recycle Utah has to be out of its current location, which is owned by the city, by April. Recycle Utah would have 2 acres here, more than twice the size of the current center. Henney wasn't sure if the city will sell the land or donate it to Recycle Utah.
You know, we haven't gotten that far into it, but I kind of doubt it. I think, we gave them a great lease on the land where they currently are. I think we'd probably work out something very similar to that, and we would ask them to fundraise and use their capital to build their facility out, which has kind of been the framework that we have talked to them about for the last 8 years.
At this point, there are not cost estimates for the project, and it wasn't clear whether a zoning change would be needed. In other business, the council approved a revised current year budget and a provisional budget for fiscal year 2021. Budget manager Jed Briggs has taken the unused walkability funds, about $4 million of the $15 million that voters authorized back in 2007, to be used for other shovel-ready projects. And he says he's okay with reallocating these voter-approved funds to be used in a different project than originally intended. The money has been sitting in reserves for years, slated to address the intersection at Kearns Boulevard and Park Avenue, known as the Jans to Dans corridor. While original plans considered an underground tunnel for pedestrian and bike traffic there, Henny says that the money will be used elsewhere.
This is taking walkability funds and allocating it to shovel-ready projects that we can make some progress on right now, but it's all walkability. So I see it all as under the same umbrella, and I think it's accomplishing the same goals of improving, you know, our alternate modes of transportation and making things more friendly for pedestrians and bicyclists and getting people out of automobiles. So, yeah, I think it's terrific.
Henny added that we will see bus stop improvements from the Fresh Market stop there around the corner to 248 instead. As we've reported, the Utah legislature met in its fifth special session of the year last Thursday, just days after lawmakers settled on a budget for the upcoming fiscal year. COVID-19 hit hard and shut down the state's commerce for almost 3 months. On the phone with a recap of that special session, I have State Representative Tim Quinn. He represents District 54, which includes Wasatch County, as well as the city limits of Park City. Good morning to you, Tim.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks so much for joining us. So do you expect to be called back to any more special sessions before your term ends at the end of the year?
Yes. We tentatively have a special session planned for August 20th. And I wouldn't be surprised if there was another one in October.
All right. And the August 20th, why is that needed?
We continue to tweak the budget. Revenue estimates are changing weekly as things start to open or things delay opening. So we need to go back in August to tweak the budget. And there'll be a few other items as well. I mean, I think we passed 25, 26, 27 bills last Thursday, many of them pertaining to the budget, but there were other things in there as well.
Right. And then just this past weekend, we saw the two records set for the number of COVID-19 cases being tested positive. How does that play into all of this? Given that we're seeing some, you know, reopening of business, and yet now we're seeing kind of the impacts of it as well.
I have not. I'm actually out of town in Georgia. I have not seen the numbers that you're referring to, but certainly there's an ongoing discussion about what counties, what areas of the state should be open and what areas should remain in yellow. And I think the governor is looking at the data and making those decisions based on that data.
Well, the biggest item on that 26-plus item agenda last week was, of course, repealing the budget that was approved in March and then approving a new one. Can you give us the Reader's Digest version of what you did with the budget?
Well,
actually, it was this year's and next year's as well, right?
There were, well, certainly parts of it, correct. I think the key points to take away from it was that there was a lot of money that had to be shifted. There were budgets that were cut. I think IGG budget was cut 18%. It was the largest portion of the budget that was cut. But education had an actual 1.8% increase, which some may argue wasn't enough. But I think under the circumstances where we're $1.5 billion short from what we projected in revenue, that's an incredible feat. We did tap into the rainy day funds somewhat. And social services were held harmless. Social services were not cut. Those two budgets, like I said, education increased and social services weren't cut. Everything else was cut between 1% and 18%.
And what was promising to probably be the best education, best year for education in years, was the fact that the WPU went from a 6% increase in March down to the 1.8% last week. You also, though, included funding for student enrollment growth and education technology. If, and by chance, that things do look better come August, where would you put that extra money. Would you try to make up for the cuts in education, or do you have other projects that need to be taken care of?
We have not had that, well, at least as a body, as a whole body, we have not had those discussions. I think it would be a little premature to count on additional revenue or extra revenue at this point. We're doing, fiscal analysts are doing their best job at trying to figure out, as certain counties and cities reopen, obviously Salt Lake County contributes a lot of money to the state, and it is still under yellow and may be for quite some time. So I don't know that we ought to be having discussions about possible future revenue until it occurs. But whether we would add some to education or make up the difference in some of the areas we cut, we don't know. We haven't had those discussions yet.
And then one of the bills you passed, House Bill 5011, that designates that 10% of all new education fund revenue to the WPU before any other budget items are considered. Was this a way to ensure that the November ballot question isn't jeopardized?
I don't know that it could be couched that way, but it was a negotiation between the state and stakeholders in education, the State Board of Education, the Superintendents Association, as well as the UEA. It was a very, very last-minute bill. Let me rephrase that. The negotiations went up until the very last minute with UEA, and they finally came to the table and said that they would agree to that. So I think certainly it has a relationship with that November ballot question. But I don't know that if we had not passed that, it would have put that in jeopardy.
So it sounds like education, I mean, it could have been worse, right? It could have been
Been a disaster.
Right. And so I guess, you know, here in the Park City School District, I mean, they cut their budget by 10%. It sounds like they may have overdone that.
Well, I mean, depends upon what areas they cut and where those revenues were drawn from. Is it some of their capital expenditures or is it in the classroom? And I don't know. I'm not familiar with Park City's districts particularly. But yeah, I think what everybody needs to realize is that this is a very difficult year. It's an unprecedented year. When you're looking at a $20 billion budget and you come up $1.5 billion short, yes, we've received federal funds, but those federal funds have a lot of strings attached to them. We can only use them in certain areas and in certain ways. We can't backfill budgets necessarily. So all of that being said, I think everyone should be satisfied and even happy that we were able to increase. We were, like you said, we paid for new enrollment, new students, and increased their budget 1.8%. And I think given the year and the situation we're in, that was a phenomenal feat. And Executive Appropriations Committee and those people working on the budget should be applauded for their efforts.
Yeah, but just so you know, Park City did take some capital projects off, but they also no raises and no step and lane changes for teachers. So it was pretty drastic here. But let's talk a little bit about the House Bill 5010, which you referred to. It's a $62 million basically fund. This came from the federal funds that the state received for the part of the CARES Act?
Correct. This, I'm assuming, and I don't, when we're in a special session like that, these bill numbers don't mean a whole lot. I believe you're referring to Representative Spinlove's bill.
Yes, correct.
To help kind of reopen the economy and stimulate the economy. I voted for the bill. I spoke out against it and voted against it in committee last week, but on the House floor, I voted for it. Yes, they are federal funds. Yes, I do believe that they will help many of the small businesses that have been hurt, restaurants, theaters, those types of things. But there's very little oversight as far as who can get the funds and how they can be used. We've asked that 50% of the funds that a business receives goes directly to customers or potential customers to help them make decisions. But there's no way to audit that. And the one comment I'll make that I made in committee was, yes, this is federal money, but the federal government is trillions and trillions of dollars in debt. And if states continue to take these monies without some way to shore up and make an attempt to balance the federal budget, we're only going to get worse as a country. And just because the federal government offers it doesn't mean we ought to take it all the time. So, but again, I voted for it on the floor. If it's used properly, I think it will have some positive effect on the economy, and that's what we all hope.
Right. And how is that going to be worked out, though, in terms of who gets what? Because as we saw, you know, when those SBA loans first came out, we saw, you know, organizations that maybe didn't really need it, get it.
Right. And there are some stipulations. I think it's only, there's a lot of details in it, so I may miss some of this. But I think you only get $100 per full-time employee. You do have to prove that you were negatively impacted by coronavirus. Like I said, the hope is, the requirement is that 50% of the funds you do receive is given back to customers in the form of, you know, hey, buy one, get one free, something like that. So there are some stipulations, but yes, there's an audit problem. There's not a lot of way for us to police how they're going to use it, but we did put some parameters in there so that we hope that the money will be used properly and trust the citizens and the employers that are asking for it.
And you also mentioned that you did have to tap into the rainy day fund, I think, by about $100 million. Does that get repaid back when the economy improves?
Yeah, there's some statutory language that requires us to put certain monies in a rainy day fund, but it has to do with monies that are over projected funds from projected revenues from the LFA. But you have to understand, we have multiple rainy day funds in the state. We tapped into several of them, far exceeding that $100 million you're referring to. But over time, as the economy improves, yes, those funds will be put back and replenish those accounts.
And then you also mentioned that the social services funds were not cut. If this wasn't an election year, may it have been?
You know, I think everybody knows I'm not up for re-election. And to be honest with you, while yes, there are people who think in terms of politics all the time, in terms of elections, I really do think that both sides of the aisle, both parties went into this session. Speaker Wilson even asked, hey, let's put politics aside. And we're all on the same team, Team Utah. And I think that everybody went in with the best of intentions and let's do what's right. I don't know that politics played a whole lot into this.
And in terms of the projects that had to be cut, I get basically capital projects, right?
A lot of the IGG is capital projects, that's correct.
Yeah. And so, I mean, that's not too difficult to do, right? I mean, there's a lot of kind of discretionary funding, you know, funding of projects there, right?
Right. But higher education and some of their capital projects were cut. Executive offices and criminal justice, that was cut. Like I said, every department, every agency in the state took some cuts except for social services and education.
All right. Any other thoughts about this special session that you'd like to highlight?
No, it was a whirlwind day. I think we were in session about 11 hours. For a special session, the number of bills that we passed was quite remarkable. So
I was going to say, yeah, I mean, that sometimes takes weeks.
Yes. Usually when we're in special session, we're looking at two or three bills, not 25.
Right. And then in terms of, I mean, the State Board of Education is now asking school districts to kind of come up with plans. Is that in their ballpark here? Is that they're the ones that decide whether or not schools open, or is that a legislature decision?
To be honest with you, Leslie, I'm not certain who has the authority over that. I would assume that it's a concerted effort between the executive branch, legislative branch, but primarily the state school board. That would be my guess.
Okay.
Certainly, no matter who's in charge of that decision, they would want input from all parties that are concerned.
All right, and finally, of course, we've got the primary election coming up to replace you, and then, of course, the general election there in November, but a couple of Republican candidates that I'll be talking to this week. Any advice for them?
Just, you and I had this discussion 7 or 8 weeks ago after the general session. Who's ever elected, it's always my hope that they vote their principles, they vote their values, their votes are honest, and they leave politics out of this. That's what I hope for whoever replaces me.
All right. Tim Quinn, State Representative for District 54. Always appreciate taking the time to talk to us.
Thanks, Leslie. Have a good day.
Well, Leadership Park City has canceled this fall's city tour and extended this year's programming into November, that due to COVID-19. KPCW's Sean Higgert has more.
It's been 46 years since Leadership Park City's founder, Miles Raidman, planned his first city tour for the group. This year, the group was set to visit Flagstaff, Arizona in September, and it is the first year Raidman has had to cancel the trip.
Hey, you know, everyone knows that this is these are strange times, so we have to do what we have to do, and we just didn't feel comfortable about taking 60 to 70 people on a bus and some vans and going someplace, given the realities of what's out there, and I wouldn't say we're canceling it. I would say we are rescheduling it.
Due to the COVID-19 outbreak, members of the community-wide leadership training program have met virtually on Zoom since March. Raidman says the experience has not been the same since the program relies so much on personal interaction. Leadership Park City has also extended their programming into November with the hopes of meeting in person for three more sessions before concluding the program for 2020.
It's really a networking program. And so it's not really conducive to Zoom meetings. And we have met in March, April, May, and June. So we had four Zoom meetings. But usually we meet for 6 hours. What we've learned is nobody could stand Zoom for more than 2 hours. You know, we're all sort of suffering death by Zoom at this point.
Raidman adds that there is a possibility of a spring tour for this year's class if conditions allow, and Leadership Park City will begin recruiting for next year's class in November. Sean Higgins, KPCW News.
There are two Republican candidates on the ballot this year for the primary election, Randy Favero and Mike Kohler. The winner of the June 30th primary will go on to face Democrat Megan Miller in the November general election to replace State Representative Tim Quinn, who represents the 54th District. On the phone to tell us a little bit more about himself, I have Randy Favero. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you this morning?
I'm doing well. Thanks. So tell us a little bit about yourself, what you do, what your background is, Randy.
Well, I'm a born and raised Utahn from Weber County. I'm the son and descendant of immigrants from Italy and England, all farmers and ranchers. I graduated from Ogden High School, spent a couple of years in Italy, then met my wife on a blind date, and now have four children and 11 and a half grandchildren. You might say music is in my DNA. You and I first met when I was leading the Interfaith Council sing-along. I went to school on a music scholarship, then put myself through grad school playing in a band six nights a week. Got a couple of degrees from the University of Utah. The last was an MBA. And I've had the great benefit of not only a background and a history in Utah, but having the opportunity to experience life in other places. Out of grad school, I went to work for the IBM company. And it's back in the day when it stood for I've Been Moved. We moved to L.A., then San Francisco, then Connecticut, and worked in New York for 20 years. And left IBM, went to work for Netscape, started a worldwide professional services and education building business. And I've done a couple of startups, and then September 11th hit. We were living in Connecticut at the time, and we lost seven people in our community, all of them relatives of our kids' friends and a son of a lady my wife worked with, and we woke up one morning and said, it's time to go home. So we've been back in Utah, specifically Summit County, for 18 years now. I worked for Novell for a while, and then now have a consulting company that focuses on what we call collaborative innovation.
So what skills, given all of that, do you think make you a good lawmaker?
Well, the experience of learning and observing from not only large companies and small companies, having started my own businesses, et cetera, but on both coasts have helped me learn and observe things that are applicable to where Utah is right now with the state of growth. The fact that I have no agenda, no conflicts of interest, no obligations to anybody other than the residents, and the fact that I am a facts and data guy, you know, I'm driven by let's make the best decisions based on facts and the data, and I apply that broad experience that I mentioned, I think gives me the skill base to add, let's call it a fresh perspective to Utah State Legislature.
Well, Why did you want to run for office?
Well, really two reasons. One, I have a partner in Boston who said, Favero, you've got a lot of great ideas that have been burning a hole in your pocket. That plus my observations that I've worked for the last 5 years with legislators and with the State Board of Education And it's given me an observation again that we tend to be a little myopic, sometimes parochial in our views, and I just believe that a fresh perspective would be beneficial, and those are the two primary reasons that drove me to run.
Yeah. Usually we see, though, somebody, you know, they've run for school board or county council or, you know, city council, things like that, but it doesn't sound like you have that in your tool.
Well, I served on the Summit County Board of Adjustment for 4 years.
Okay.
But I am a newcomer to politics, and frankly, to me, again, with no agenda, no conflicts of interest, that's a plus as opposed to a potential negative.
So what do you think the biggest differences are between you and your challenger in this primary, Mike Kohler?
Well, I think it's experience that can be brought to the state. You know, I served on an ad hoc planning commission in the Sauceda Valley in the San Ramon area, outside on the East Bay of San Francisco, at a time when it was growing like crazy. And the opportunity to be involved and watch what was happening, you know, relative to what the planning commissions and the developers were doing, and then be able to put public input into it. Let's say this, I've experienced growth on both coasts, and being able to see what went right and what didn't go so right. And so that experience just, you know, outside of Utah, I think, is a differentiator, as well as the background in business. Again, large companies and small have given me the opportunity to see the impacts of decisions that we make. And most importantly, the whole notion of accountability and transparency. You don't have the opportunity in business to be able to get away with not being accountable. And I think that we, as taxpayers, deserve our lawmakers to be held accountable for every taxpayer dollar that's spent, and there needs to be transparency in that as it's going along.
Yeah. Sam, can a Summit County candidate win this election, or does it really require somebody to, just because it covers all, District 54 covers all of Wasatch County as opposed to just within the Park City municipal limits?
Yeah, that's a great question. And when I first got in the race, there was council that said Wasatch tends to vote territorially, and you don't have a prayer. In the convention, we proved differently. In speaking to many of the delegates, they were looking for a change. They were looking for something other than the old guard, if you will. And so we got enough to move this to a primary, and in conversations with many of the constituents, we're getting the same feeling. So I think that not only does Park City need and deserve representation, but I think that Wasatch County is looking for broader experience in these times of change and growth that certainly make it plausible for a Summit County resident to win this seat.
Well, if you should go on to win the primary, how do you beat Democrat Megan Miller? She only lost the last election. I think it was within like 200 votes.
Yeah, I understand it was very close, and I think it's relying back on not only experience but vision, and the whole notion that, you know, politics shouldn't play a lot in representing the community. There needs to be a broad representation for everybody that lives here. And I am more focused on doing the right thing and making the right decisions than just saying a Republican needs to beat a Democrat. This is all about experience and who can bring the most to the table for the residents of Park City and for Wasatch County.
Well, you say you have no agenda, but what are the biggest issues facing the state in your mind?
Well, the issues that I'm mostly focused on are, as we know, we have taken a hit with the economy, and so rebuilding this economy after the pandemic is absolutely essential. But it's more than that. It's creating an environment for sustainable economic development. I believe that Utah is where it is today because of work that Bangeter and Levitt did, laying a foundation for us to be the best state to do business, and, you know, in virtually all of the categories, we're top three. And that's what we need to continue focusing on. How are we going to lay this foundation? You know, and there are three legs to that stool of economic development. One is innovation. Two is building a skilled workforce, which means a link between business and education. And the third is accessible capital. The third we can't influence directly, but as businesses do well, we can attract more access, more capital in, and of course businesses and tax revenues contribute to helping us have that. So that's the first thing. The second thing is we have got to improve student outcomes. If you ask the person on the street what the biggest problem with education is, the 95% will say it's funding. Well, the biggest problem is our student outcomes haven't improved. We've better than doubled the spending over the last 25 to 30 years, but outcomes have stayed flat. That's the problem we have to solve. Now, funding may be a root cause, but it isn't the problem. So figuring out how we improve student outcomes and build ourselves a workforce that's going to carry us into the next 15, 20, 25 years, that's absolutely essential for us. And the third is, you know, back to the point I made a moment ago of transparency and accountability. I've seen far too many bills that have been passed that only after the fact you go back to check to see how we did, and the money's either been spent on something different or we haven't gotten the returns that we as taxpayers deserve. So, you know, I will always ask the question of, you know, are we getting out of our spend what we as taxpayers hope for and expect. So those are the three things that I think are most important for us. There are, you know, a lot of other issues that we have to solve, air quality and the issue of the inland port and things like that. But if we rebuild the economy and build this base of a sustainable economic environment, those things will have the funds, et cetera, to apply to get those problems solved.
Yeah. I want to ask you, though, I mean, when you talk about improving student outcomes, I mean, studies show it's not in the classroom. It's parental oversight. So the best students are those that have parents that push the students. So, I mean, how you know, what do you do with that?
Well, you're onto a great point. We have to do a couple of things. First of all, we have to build the perception and observation that the profession of being a teacher is a highly regarded profession, and there has to be the respect for the teachers that comes from the students, it comes from the parents, it comes from the business environment. Everybody needs to understand and acknowledge that those teachers need to be respected. As we raise that level of respect and continue outreach back to the parents, you know, I think we have an opportunity to change that and get more parental involvement, because that is clearly one of the impacts on this. We also find that that early involvement, and there are, you know, many of our families, whether it's they don't have time or don't know how to engage their children, the earlier that we can get kids reading and reading at grade level prepares them for a better educational experience. And there are programs now that are rolling out through the state, the Upstart program for early literacy, et cetera, that is making a phenomenal difference. And so we've got to seek out those situations that are really the canaries in the coal mine to tell us how good the education system is, and make sure that early education and early parental involvement is happening to enable the kids to perform better when they're in the classroom. And frankly, that gives the teachers a better opportunity to focus their skill sets on the individuals, because we've got to drive to a more of a personalized learning or individualized learning program to enable these kids to perform well.
All right. 30 seconds, Randy, about why Republicans should vote for you June 30th.
Well, again, I represent a fresh perspective. I've got broad experience from both coasts, from large companies and small, from deep community involvement, and I represent something that is not tied to any particular political agenda. As I said, you know, I make decisions based on the facts and the data, and it's all about the doing what's best for the state of Utah and for the citizens and residents of this state. So I hope that the Republicans see that as an advantage, and that broad experience and that fresh perspective, and hope they will indeed cast their votes for me.
All right, Randy, I appreciate your time this morning. Thank you.
I'll say nice to chat with you again. Thank you.
That's Randy Favero again, one of the two Republican candidates on the primary election ballot this year. Again, you should have your ballots. If you don't, you better check with the county clerk's office to make sure that you have. And again, voters are going to be able to drop their ballots in the mailbox June 30th as well. That's a new change this year. But there are drop boxes all over the county, so you can find one of those as well. Well, the Heber City Council last week, council members approved a new budget. They also discussed the return of the Heber Market on Main and debated city streetlights, dark skies, and short-term rentals in the city. On the phone with me now with a recap is council member Rachel Kaler. Good morning, Rachel.
Good morning, Leslie. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, glad you could make it. So council started with a work session. You heard from City Manager Matt Brower with an update on the pending annexation on the property north of the city. The biggest questions, he said, are about getting the annexation is what it will look like in terms of architecture and density. And he showed you some examples of properties in the Tahoe Valley area, noting that the architecture kind of blended in and didn't stand out. What did you think of the presentation?
So this is the North Village Overlay Zone that we're talking about, and it's north and east of Highway 40, and it is an annexation, pending annexation that the city is considering. So we have multiple developers that have come to us. They have been working with the county for several years, and if Heber City does move forward with this annexation, it's a lot of different properties. It's a lot of different developers that have different ideas. For me, this is a really important step in Heber City's future. We need to decide what that corridor is going to look like. My hope is that it's not just apartment complexes, that we can really make it a commercial, mixed-use, residential area with some great parks and trails. And so I think the city manager has a great vision and is guiding us, but we will meet again this Wednesday at 6 o'clock. It's an open meeting to really discuss as a council what we're going to do with the North Village moving forward.
All right. And I guess, again, how this fits in with the newly adopted Envision Heber 2050 plan. Councilmember Ryan Stack said that he was worried about a hillside of density. So you're kind of there with him?
I am absolutely there with him. Now, we recognize that they did have conversations with the county, but my understanding is very few of these developers actually have their entitlements. And so as we move forward and work with them, I hope that we can really fuse in a lot of the feedback that we got last year. I happened to be on that Envision 2050 committee. And while we recognize developers and property owners have a right to develop, I think we as a city also have a lot of say in what we want this to look like. And so that's where open space and trails and parks really does come into play. And what kind of build out do we want to see on that hillside?
City manager also presented an idea to bring back the Heber Market on Main. That's typically been a concert and farmers market Thursday nights at City Park. And of course, we have new requirements for large gatherings. One of those is that you have to get the contact information for everyone who's there in case someone comes down with COVID-19. Plus, you've got to keep everyone at least 6 feet away from each other. The city manager said that the city could make lemons out of lemonade by putting hula hoops on the ground with numbers inside so families know where they can sit. And then you could have kind of hula hoop contests during breaks in the concert. You said citizens want something like this. Why?
Yeah, we have really seen a lot of people asking for some kind of community event. We recognize that the market on Main, this was going to be a big celebration for us this summer as we come out with a new branding of the market on Main. And, you know, obviously with COVID, we want to be careful with things, but there should be an opportunity for people to get outside and enjoy the beautiful weather that we have in the summer. And so what the city is looking at, and with the approval of the health department, what we would like to do is move forward with the market on Main July 9th and 16th. And it will be a very scaled down version. There will not be any vendors. There'll be minimal food vendors, possibly some food trucks, and then music. So we would have to identify entrances and exits and, like you said, get the information of the people that are coming. So it's tricky, but we just feel like we need to do something that gives our community something to look forward to this summer.
Yeah, that's interesting, though, because it's in terms of an economic impact, it really has none. It's more of a social thing. And again, we know that people close together is not a good thing for the economy. So I guess, doesn't it seem risky to you guys?
So that's why we've put these parameters in place, and we are identifying, can we do an entrance, can we do an exit, there's social distancing. There isn't a lot of economic, you wouldn't think the economic driver is there, but just getting people out, maybe stopping through a fast food restaurant as they come through, coming down to the downtown area, does provide some stimulus into the local economy, and it just gives people a chance to take a deep breath. Our hoping is they take a deep breath 6 feet apart.
So have you gotten the write-off, the okay, from the county health department?
We have not yet. And so all of this is definitely dependent on the health department.
Wasatch County sadly reporting its third death on Friday due to COVID-19. Both Wasatch and Summit counties are in the top three counties for COVID-19 per capita. Heber City Mayor Colleen Potter said that people appear to be polarized about whether you should wear a mask. What are you seeing and hearing from residents in Heber City about the subject?
You know, it's hard when you go downtown, and it really is a 50-50. I mean, you go into the grocery stores, and I think some people are very mindful of spacing and keeping to themselves and wearing masks, and other people are saying, you know what, I just need to go back and live my life. So in our family, my mother is currently going through chemotherapy, so we are very mindful of her immune system. We're keeping our distance. We're wearing masks and washing as much as we can. But I do recognize there are people that just psychologically need to move forward and get back to work.
Council voted to allow an affordable housing project called Parkview Place at the south end of town to reduce the number of streetlights. That led to a meaty discussion about how the number of streetlights, with city council members kind of bemoaning how bright the Heber Valley has become at night. It sounds like everyone thinks that there is work to be done here. What's the next step?
So one of our objectives that we identified in our early meeting in January was dark sky and protecting the dark sky that we have here in the Heber Valley. So the concern was, if we're building and then we're forcing all these streetlights to go in and they're 300 yards apart, we're just compounding the problem of too many lights that are dimming our sky. And so our city engineer encouraged us as a city council to drive around our community. It started with the Parkview development, and we did reduce the streetlight requirement by three lights, feeling like, well, there's a light directly across the street. There'll be two-story buildings here that will have lights on them. I think that's something that's really important, that as we move forward, we're mindful of what growth is doing to our sky and making sure that we can still see the stars at night. I mean, as a child, that was one of my favorite things about the summer, is to go out and look up. And if we don't protect that by limiting or at least scaling back those light requirements as a city, I think we're doing a disservice to our children as they grow older and maybe aren't looking up as often.
So are you going to do that legislatively to limit the number of streetlights?
So that's what the city engineer asked us to do, is to drive around and look at what's currently in place. And as we move forward with the build out, as we talked about the North Village, are there opportunities? There's new technology. There's new LED lights. We can put the lights facing more downward. It just seems like, and I've been driving around the last couple of days looking up and looking at the different styles of lights. There are certainly some street lights that are very bright and obnoxious. And they mentioned a few that I've gone out at night and really said, wow, what kind of service is this doing except for being this beacon? And other areas, it's interesting, there's a development that was put in 22 years ago that has basically freeway lighting. I mean, you drive down its main corridor of the subdivision and it's large gray I-15 lights. And so, you know, as technology's improved, I think we can make our city better by not lighting up the night sky.
Also, a discussion about short-term, even nightly rentals and the pros and cons of limiting where in the city that residents are allowed to do this. Do you think they should be allowed citywide?
So my personal opinion is I don't think so. I really do like the ordinance that Jamie Barron, our city planner, has put together. and in limiting short-term rentals. And what our goal and my goal personally is to create an environment and a community that people can afford to live here and not just sell off to investors that are looking for a quick return on short-term rentals. So the current proposal is Old Town Heber will be an area that we really want to identify as an opportunity for investors to come in, create short-term rentals in that old town, but protecting our neighborhoods by not letting them go off to the highest bidder. But we do have parameters where if you're already having a short-term rental, or if you're using your house, or you've got a bedroom for an Airbnb, limiting the number of guests. So, for example, if you've got a large house, we're limiting the number of guests to 8 people. So that way you're still able to rent that out to a family, but what we're trying to avoid is renting it out to an entire family reunion that you've got 12 cars out spilling out onto the roadway and really creating a distraction for your neighbors. So we'll have more discussions on that. It was just a preliminary discussion with the council. But I do think the planning department, there's been a committee that was put in place that really looked at the pros and cons. And so more to come on what we actually pass and legislate for short-term rentals.
All right. Finally, the council approved next year's fiscal year budget, almost $31 million. Did that have to be cut due to some of the economic impacts of COVID?
Absolutely. So I was really appreciative of Wes Bingham and our city manager, Matt Brower, for the time and the consideration that they put into this budget. They did reduce the budget based on some projections, but our city budget really is largely funded by sales tax revenue, some property tax, not a lot of tourism dollars, and that's where we're seeing the biggest hit from an economic standpoint is tourism in our area. But our sales tax dollars, surprisingly, were up 11% in March. And so we're attributing that to more people are shopping online, and we're actually receiving more tax benefits because people, rather than going to Utah County or Salt Lake County, are ordering from home, and we're actually receiving those sales dollars. So we did reduce the budget, but we were mindful of so many of these factors that are playing in, and the reports that we were given is we're actually not going to be hit as hard as some areas because we're less dependent from a city standpoint on those tourism tax dollars.
Okay. Hey, Rachel, I appreciate your time this morning. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Rachel Kaler, a member of the Heber City Council. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Well, tonight, the Wasatch County Open Lands Board will meet to consider giving $2 million to save one of the last dairy farms in the Heber Valley. The Albert Kohler Legacy Farm is on 103 acres between River Road on the west and the Provo River on the east, about 1800 north. The Kohler family has operated the farm since the 1800s. Currently, they process milk and cheese on site and sell it in a red building adjacent to the proposed protected property. The family also operates a cafe and provides tours of the cheesemaking facility to local students and tourists. In 2018, Wasatch County residents approved a $10 million open space bond. In April 2019, the Kohler family signed a conservation easement agreement with Utah Open Lands for $7 million. $4.25 million of that has been raised from federal, state, and local funds, including $1 million from Midway City in March. According to Utah Open Lands, if the land is not put in a conservation easement, it could be developed into 80 home sites. The Wasatch County Open Lands Board public hearing is scheduled to begin. The public hearing is at 6:30 p.m. The meeting will be held online due to COVID-19 concerns. Citizens can submit their public comment via email at openlands@wasatch.utah.gov. For more information on how to participate in real time via your computer, you can go to our website, kpcw.org. Degrees already here in Old Town Park City. Again, stay tuned. We've got Mountain Money coming up, followed by, or I should say, we've got NPR headline news coming up, followed by Mountain Money. Again, we've got 60 degrees, looking for plenty of sun today with a high of 76. You've been listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW Park City. It's 9 o'clock.